I'd like to first thank Rachel and Chuck for picking me up this afternoon. They really kind of babysat me, and it was very special. You know, it's always nice when you go to places outside of your own hometown when you meet people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are friendly. And that's been a trait that I found no matter where I've gone. You know, no matter where I've gone, I found people that were really friendly. And I just want to thank you guys for being so gracious this afternoon. And I also want to thank the committee for inviting me here. I'm from that school of thought in Alcoholics Anonymous that believes anytime I'm invited to speak anywhere, whether it's a meeting of two people or a meeting of 2,000, that it's a privilege. It's a real privilege. And I suspect I really believe that because it wasn't too long ago that nobody was inviting me anywhere. And if they made the mistake of inviting me somewhere once, you could be assured that they would not invite me back a second time. And it always makes me feel like a child, very childlike when I'm invited. I remember when I got the phone call from Bill, I was literally like a child. I was so excited and so grateful. You know, like little kids are grateful for small gifts. You know, anything makes a kid feel wonderful. After that, I felt kind of embarrassed because I was feeling this way, and my sponsor reminded me that it would be to my advantage if I never got rid of that feeling, if I always was grateful for things that were given to me, regardless of what kind of things they were. And that's really what my story is all about. It's about lots of gratitude for who I am today, even for who I was years ago, because had I not been that woman, I wouldn't be the woman that I am right now. And I've come to cherish those memories, even though I choose not to repeat that past. I would like to welcome those of you that are relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I suspect there are plenty of you. Let me ask you, when I turn my head, can you still hear me over here? You can't. Okay. I'd like to welcome you that are relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous and say that if you become willing to do what's suggested in this program, and not necessarily what I suggest, nor what other individuals suggest, but what comes out of the book, the 12 and 12, the big book, as Bill sees it, any of our literature, if you become willing to do what we suggest in this program, you're going to find that your life is going to take the kind of turn that you never, ever would have imagined. Ever. I mean, I stand before you this evening a living example, a walking, talking, living example of what Alcoholics Anonymous can do for you, but more than that, what Alcoholics Anonymous can teach you to do for yourself. That's the kind of example I stand before you tonight as. I like to think that my story is one of hope, and it is. It even gives me hope, and it's my story. I've lived it. But every time I share, and even when I just sit, like this afternoon we were at lunch, and I was talking to one of Chuck's sponsees, and I was just sort of recounting some of my life, and I started to cry because I am so grateful for where I am today, and I remember so vividly where I've come from. I was born 38 years ago in Atlanta, Georgia, so I am very familiar with the South. I don't remember an awful lot about those early days, I must tell you. My family moved to New York when I was 6 years old, and for the very first time in my life, I was to experience prejudice. Not so much racial prejudice, although I felt that too, but it was more the kind of prejudice that a little kid who moves from a very backward community, the kind of prejudice or the kind of feelings they experience when they move to a much more sophisticated northern town. And although Atlanta, Georgia today is very cosmopolitan and very, very chic, at that time, in the 1950s, it was run by Lester Maddox, and it wasn't too chic. And it wasn't too cosmopolitan, and for a little black kid growing up in the South, it wasn't fun. And my family moved to New York, and I think if I had to pick out one reason why I drank, which there were so many, but if I had to pick out one, it was probably because as a small child, I always felt different. I think more than anything else, the thing that really rings very clear in my brain about my growing up was that I felt different. It was always like that old saying, a square peg in a round hole, never quite fitting. It was always as though there was a party going on outside, and I was trying to be a part of it, but I was never invited. I never quite fit. And I think my whole life, not only as a child, but even coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, everything I did, I think, was so that I would try to fit, so that I could just be on par with the world. And at that stage of the game, I didn't even want to be better than you. At that stage of the game, I just wanted to be on par. And I guess if there was anyone looking at me, anyone who was sensitive to feelings and to children, anyone that probably saw me as a small child, they probably knew that at some point I was going to find something to make the pain of growing up in my own reality go away. Just something. Didn't matter what it was. Because being a little kid, first growing up in the South and then moving to the South Bronx in New York, it just wasn't fun. And it was always a torturous experience. And for me, my earliest escape in life was literature and the silver screen. I loved books. My mother's a librarian, and we used to have reams and reams of books all over the house. In every room, every wall was stacked high with books. And sometimes I would just take a book off the shelf and I'd start to read. And I'm not sure if my mother thought that I was trying to be a smart kid, but what was really going on was when I started to read, what you thought of me just didn't matter anymore. What you thought of me, what I thought of me didn't matter anymore, because between those binders, I was like Cinderella. I became pretty, I became smart, I became capable of fitting in with anybody. And eventually, that's what alcohol and drugs were to do for me also. And I also liked movies. I liked women like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. I mean, those were my kind of idols. They were women with a glass in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand, and they didn't take a whole lot of crap off anybody. And I needed that, because I was a small child with this huge hole inside of her gut, and I didn't know how to fill it. I didn't learn until years later, after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, that the way to fill that hole was through the inside out, not from the outside in. I didn't know that at the time. And so I kept using these things to try to make my pain go away, and it worked for a long time. I mean, for a long time as a child, I forgot that I was growing up in poverty. I forgot that I was eating plaster off the walls and that I was sleeping with huge rats. Because when I read and when I got caught up in the movies, my life was very different. It was very different. And it was about the age of 14 when, instead of taking me away from the pain of my own reality, it made it perfectly clear to me that where I was just where I was. I was this poor little black kid growing up in the South Bronx, and that was it. There was nothing else in store for me. That was my life. And it was at that stage of the game that I got introduced to the wonderful world of drugs and alcohol. I don't harp on drugs because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am an alcoholic, and I got sober in this program. But it's really important for me to acknowledge that, because more and more I'm hearing people come into the rooms that seem to want to read the traditions the way they want to read it. For example, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I've heard more people come in within the last few years who have found it acceptable to use drugs but not drink, or vice versa, because, you know, they're different and unique. And because the tradition says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Well, I need to just say for myself that the people that I got sober with in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that what this was all about for me was learning how to live in a world that I desperately tried to run away from all of my life without the aid of any kind of chemical. Nothing. Without the aid of any chemical. And so it's very important for me to just acknowledge today that I haven't had a drink. I haven't had a drug. I've had nothing that alters my mind. I'm sober 11 and a half years in this program. And for that length of time, I have not had... I haven't found it necessary to pick up anything in that period of time. But it wasn't like that before. As I said, I'm 38, and so I'm a product of the 60s. I mean, I grew up in a time when, at least in New York, anything went. And it was really quite sad as I think back on it. I'm so surprised that I'm still around to even tell the story. I remember there were times, and first I might add, I was an artist. I went to a specialized high school, art and design in New York. And being a creative person during the 60s made it even worse. It sort of gave me a license to do anything I wanted to do. I mean, I could get high in the middle of the streets and I could always say, well, but I'm a creative sort. You know, I'm only perfecting my craft. And this is what I actually believe. I mean, I actually believe that. I'd walk through the streets with a glassine bag and a straw, or I'd have a bottle and I'd be so wasted. But because I was trying to perfect my craft, it was okay. And, you know, it's really quite sad when I think about it. And last October, I attended a pre-high school reunion reception. My 20th high school reunion is coming up very shortly. And we had a reception a few months back. And we were going through the yearbook, and I have since lost my yearbook in all of my travels. And we were going through the yearbook, and it was very sad because people were pointing out some of the people they knew for a fact were no longer with us. People that had died from drug overdoses. People that had died from the Vietnam War. And when we got to my picture, people were reminded of where I had come from, and they were very surprised, too, that I was standing there and so different. And, you know, it just hit me, the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, because perhaps had I not found you guys when I did, I might have, too, been one of those casualties. But you saved me. You saved me from a fate worse than death. For 12 years, I drank and used on a daily basis. From the age of 14 until the age of 26, when I crawled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not draw a sober breath. I remember when I came in and I started to read the book, there's in the 11th chapter, in A Vision for You, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about those four horsemen, bewilderment, frustration, despair, and terror. And I remember when I read that first page for the first time, it's like it just jumped out at me. It gripped a hold of my insides because I knew exactly what they were talking about. I knew that pain of living the kind of life that was so vile and so wretched on a day-to-day basis. And then the next morning coming to without a clue as to what happened. I knew the feeling of having to come to with somebody strange in my bed that I would have never, ever given a time of day to. I knew what that felt like. I knew what it felt like to be dirty. I knew what it felt like to be the kind of person that was incapable of looking at herself in the mirror because any vision that I saw was only a reflection of what was going on, which was not a pretty picture. A few years ago, there was a television movie, and I believe it was the Barbara Hutton story. And one of the things that stands out for me about that movie, although our lives were very, very different, one of the things that stood out was that she kept talking about the magic. She was constantly looking for the magic. She said that her grandfather, Mr. Woolworth, promised her if she was a good girl, she could have the magic. And, you know, she sought that magic in men, in women, in all kinds of things outside of herself. She paid a very high price to find that magic and still never found it. And you know, that was exactly how I felt. I was always looking for the magic. I was always looking for something outside of me that was going to make me whole. Something that was going to make me feel like I was just okay. Something that was going to make me acceptable to Francine. And I never could find it. I just never could find it. There were times when I'd come home from doing whatever it was that I felt the need to be doing out in the street. And I'd take showers. And I remember clearly sometimes I'd scrub my body because I wanted to get what I thought was that surface dirt off. And sometimes I'd hurt myself. I'd scrub so hard I'd have abrasions on my skin because I kept scrubbing and I kept scrubbing. And I'm sure there are some of you in this room that understand what that feeling is all about. The feeling that no amount of soap and water, no amount of perfume, no amount of pretty clothes could ever erase the kind of dirt that I was trying to remove from myself, because that kind of dirt was attached to the inside. It was a soul sickness. It says when you lie down with scum, that's what you become. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about seeking out those sordid companions. And it got to the point for this alcoholic that I became one of those sordid companions. And yet when people were looking at me from the outside, they might have seen something quite different. Because I was living on the east side of Manhattan. I was frequenting all the right places. I was attached to all the right men. I dressed well. You know, I carried myself okay. But I was dying inside. I was doing the same things living up in my castle on East 58th Street that I used to do on 116th and 8th Avenue. The only difference is that I was physically looking different and the apartments were different. But the stuff that I felt inside was all the same. It was all the same. And it was not until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was not until years later when I realized that it was an inside job, that that stuff started to dissipate. That feeling of self-hatred just started to melt away. But it didn't dissipate just by my coming and taking up the seat, as I eventually found out. It started to leave me because I became willing to do the work to make it happen. Sometimes I can't stop crying, and tonight's not one of those nights. But there are times when I start to talk about my life and I just can't stop crying. I start to cry profusely because I am so welled up with emotion, because I am not the person that I used to be. I am not that person. And for those of you that are relatively new in this program, all I say to you is that you have given yourself the most unbelievable gift you could imagine. And you probably can't imagine that right now, because maybe you're sitting back and your hands are shaking and your palms are sweaty, and you might have had one of the worst days of your recovery, and you're saying, yeah, right, it's easy for you to say. Well, it's easier today because I'm sober so long, but it wasn't so easy before, but I kept doing it. I kept showing up. And today my life is different. In 1978, I knew that clearly something was wrong with the way I was living. I knew that something was wrong. I didn't know about blackouts, but I knew that there were lapses in time. I mean, whole portions of my day just disappeared. And I couldn't figure out what the problem was. And at this time, I started to see a therapist because I realized that something wasn't right, and I thought it was my brain. For the life of me, it never dawned upon me that it was my drinking. And I'm telling you, talk about an alcoholic steeped in denial, I truly was one. I honestly didn't think that coming to in the morning, passing out at night, and not remembering most of the time, and just constantly having to drink and drug, was a problem. It didn't dawn upon me that that was the issue. And so I went to this therapist, and she suggested that I had an allergy to alcohol. Well, for any of you that are real alcoholics and remember those days, to tell that to an alcoholic that is steeped in denial is just ludicrous. And so what I did was ran out and did what any self-respecting alcoholic would do. I got an allergy test. And I'm not sure if they do it today as they used to, but it was a big head with four little needles, and they pricked you to see if you were allergic to anything. And of course I wasn't. I wasn't allergic to anything. I could do anything I wanted, so I thought. And all that did, sadly enough, was gave me more of a license to continue doing the things I did. To continue living like an animal. To continue living the kind of life that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy today. Under the guise of being happy and finding myself. At the end of 1978, after I started seeing this therapist, I decided that I was going to do what we endearingly call in Alcoholics Anonymous, take a geographic. I moved out to Las Vegas, Nevada, thinking that Vegas was going to solve my problems. Because you understand that it was New York that really was the problem. It wasn't me. I mean, it was that I was a victim of circumstances. I mean, all my life, I had never had a good break. And New York helped to create that problem. So I went off to Vegas thinking that things were going to be different. And they were different, all right. It took about 9 months before this God that I did not even believe in at the time said, enough is enough. In June of 1979, I got hit by a car in a blackout. And to date, I don't remember what happened. The last thing I recall was I was sitting in the brewery, which was a discotheque that was open in Vegas at the time. And the next thing I recall was the following morning I came to with my entire body in traction and my leg was in a cast. And I was told that I had been found on the street in a direction opposite from my house. And they didn't think I was going to live. And when they found out that I would live, They didn't think I'd ever walk again because my leg was up behind my head and the bone had come straight through. And today I have a 10-inch scar in my leg as a constant reminder of the good old days. And if there's ever a moment when I get too cocky in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I ever get to thinking because I'm sober so long that I don't have to go to so many meetings, if I ever get to think that because I'm sober so long I don't have to do service, that I don't have time to talk to sponsees, that I can let up on that rigorous program of honesty and making amends, if I ever get to the point where I put my God, the God I've come to believe in today, on the back shelf, all I need to do is take a look at my leg, as well as other body scars. But just take a look at my leg to remind me of where I've come from, and the fact that it wasn't so much fun for me. I didn't have a good time. That wasn't enough to stop me from picking up a drink, and again, for those of you that are real deal alcoholics, you understand. You understand what that's all about. You understand that when the disease of alcoholism grips a hold of you, no mere car accident is going to make you stop. No family leaving you, no loss of a job, no loss of limbs. Nothing's going to make you stop when the disease of alcoholism grabs a hold of you. And so it was with me. I couldn't stop drinking. I just couldn't stop drinking. I was 26 years old and I was dying. I could not stop drinking. And it was about a month and a half later, what I endearingly like to call that moment of clarity, it came upon me. And one morning, I came to and I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And it was really that simple. I just didn't want to die anymore. I just didn't want to die. And I picked up the phone in Vegas, and I said, I'm on crutches, I can't get to a meeting, but I'd like to go. And they said, we don't think we can get anybody to you right now, but if you can hold on, we'll get somebody to you tomorrow to take you to a meeting. And I suspect the God that I have come to believe in this program, the God that has been watching over me from day one, knew I was not going to last a day. And I got a phone call a couple of hours later from a woman who lived in the complex next door to mine, and she said, if you'd like to go to a meeting, I'll take you tonight. And I pray that was my last first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to tell you that I came into this program and I embraced it with open arms. I'd like to tell you that I was one of those people that caught it immediately and that I really wanted it. But the fact is, I wasn't. Perhaps I was even like maybe a couple of you in here. I came in with such a bad attitude. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. I used to sit in the back of the room in the inventory section. And that's what I did. I literally took everybody's inventory. Since I had crutches, I had three seats. I would take up one for my body, one for my leg, and one for my crutches, and I dared you to say anything to me. I dared you to. I'd sit in the back, and I'd dare you to make my day, you know? And very few people could. Very few people. I hung out with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who said, honey, all you have to do is come in and take up a seat, and you'll get this thing through osmosis. I mean, that was like music to my ears. I didn't even know what the word osmosis meant. But when I found out what it meant, it was fabulous because, in essence, it relinquished me of any responsibility. It said that all I had to do was come in and just take up a seat, and I could get it. I could get it. And I wanted to believe that because, you see, I've always been a very lazy person. I've always seen myself as a victim, and I've always been one of those people that wanted to just sit back and let you do it for me. Meantime, I somehow came upon this sponsor, and I'm not even sure how I found her. I think she found me. I think she sort of sniffed me out of the crowd. She was saying something completely opposite. She was saying, if you want what we have, you do what we do to get it. It's that simple. She said, there are no free rides in Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, you can look around the room, and as you stay sober, you're going to see that there are all kinds of people in these rooms. There are people that have what you want, and there are people that will not have what you want.
And she said, if you become unwilling to do what is suggested, you'll find yourself either out of this program or so miserable you'll wish you were. Louise used to say to me that it's not a mistake that in our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's an entire chapter called Into Action. And she said, furthermore, in that chapter, you're going to find most of our 12 steps discussed. And she said, more than that, in that chapter, you're going to find the promises. The promises on pages 83 and 84 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, in order to get those promises, number one, you have to be painstaking, which is what it says, but you have to continually do the footwork to get to that place. Which brought up another issue, because when I finally realized where the promises were, I was one that completely ignored that first line. And I didn't like that last line either. The first line that says, if we are painstaking about this phase, and the last line that says, if we work for these things, they will materialize. God only knows I did not want to work. I wanted to sit back, and I wanted it to wash over me. I wanted you guys to give it to me. You know, when I got sober, I was not too crazy about men, but I hated women. I remember that if there was a woman up here who looked too good, sounded too well, and had any kind of program, anything that remotely resembled a healthy program, I despised her. And I'd sit in the back and I'd just slice them up. And, you know, somebody called me on that one day, and she said, you know, Francine, I don't think it's that you hate us so much. I think it's that you hate yourself. And she was right. It wasn't that I hated you guys. I so desperately wanted what you had. I desperately wanted what you had. But number one, I was too afraid to ask for help. Because, you see, I had grown up in the streets of New York. And we never asked for help. Because you're a tough guy. That's why I could relate to men when I got sober. Because guys had that macho image, that real sick macho image to maintain. And you see, I related to that sickness because I had that same sick, macho image to maintain. I mean, growing up on the streets of New York, you never let anybody penetrate your wall. You never let them see you cry. You never let them catch you off guard. Because if you do, they'll hurt you. And so I thought that if I let you see me, if I allowed myself to pull down that facade, that you wouldn't like me anyway, because you'd see what I really was all about and you'd see who I really was. So it was easier to sit back and be a malcontent. It was easier to have a bad attitude, because then you just were afraid of me. You just stayed away from me. And some of you did. Some of you stayed away from me. But thank God there were some of you that didn't. Thank God. There were some of you that cared enough to call a spade a spade. You cared enough about me to challenge me at every step of the way, and that's what my sponsor was about. Today, I love this woman so dearly, and although I'm not in Vegas anymore, we talk often because she was my first sponsor, and she was the most important one. She was the one that cared enough about me to pull my coat to what was happening. All Louise ever talked about was action, gratitude, service, and God. I mean, it's like, give me a break. I didn't even want to know about those things. But she kept talking about them over and over and over again. You know, it was almost as though they were indelibly written on my brain. Action, gratitude, service, and God. And as much as I despised her for those things she would say to me in the beginning, that's to the degree that I love and respect and am grateful that I had a woman like that in my life. I'm grateful that I had someone who, what we sometimes like to call Nazi sponsors. You know, I kind of think that's a negative personally. I think it's too bad that if a sponsor is a big book thumper and somebody who sticks to this program says the answers are in the book, they're considered tough. I think that's unfortunate. That says something about us. But I'm grateful for her. Because I think part of who I am today had a lot to do with what she taught me when I was newly sober. Those early years, those formative years, my first 3 years of recovery, those first 3 years when I learned the very basics, the basics, I might add, that have enabled me to deal with some of the things I've had to deal with in the last few years that I never, ever would have been able to get through had it not been for those basics I learned years ago and continue to do today. In my 12th year, I go to meetings every day in Alcoholics Anonymous, and probably some of you are saying, I don't know why, you know, or is she crazy? Maybe she is. But you know what they taught me? Well, first, I heard an old-timer say once that I probably only need 2 meetings a week. But since I don't have a clue which 2 meetings I need, I go to meetings every day. And you know, that's sort of my attitude. I don't know which ones I need, you know, which ones are appropriate, so I just go. And plus, I realize that that's the stuff, the things I do today are the things that got me to this place. So why should I stop doing the things that have enabled me to show up a day at a time for almost 12 years of recovery? In 1981, I don't even know how I decided this. I made this. First, let me say this. My recovery has been unbelievable. It has been unbelievable. Sometimes I wake up in the morning today and I pinch myself because I don't believe that I am the person that used to be years ago. Everything about me is different today. The way I talk, the way I walk, the way I carry myself. Everything about me, the way I smell, the way I wear my hair, or the way I don't wear my hair today. I learned how to be a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to be a woman through the women in this program. And I learned how to be a lady through the men. I learned how to be someone who's self-respecting, someone who cares about herself, and someone who then in turn could care about others. But that has taken a long time. At my second year, I was so miserable in this program that I think had I gone another step, I would have probably gotten the strength to cut the lights out. Because the way I was going in Alcoholics Anonymous was just unbelievable. I was as bad here as I had been out there, except I wasn't drinking and using. My attitude was so horrendous, it was just unbelievable. And I came to a place in my recovery at 2 years sobriety where I was beaten into a state of reasonableness. And it was at that point that I realized for the first time that step 3 was more than just applicable to my drinking and using, that it was to be applied to my life, that it was not enough for me to just say, guys, I want you to help me not to drink and not to use. But when you suggested that I do things, it was important that perhaps I take that into consideration. When the women would suggest that I not wear see-through blouses into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't understand that, and I thought they were jealous, you know. I couldn't understand why when a man was looking at me down here, what that had to do with what I was wearing. A day at a time, I realized that the third step had to be applied to the way I behaved. It was not just about the way I was drinking and using, but the way I carried myself as a woman, as a person. It was about that time that I became willing to take an inventory for the very first time in my life, my own inventory. And I sat down with pen to paper, and I started to write. And what came out of that inventory for me was perhaps two of the best things that I hold very dear to me. One was my mother. My mother was a woman that I hated all of my life. I hated this woman. When people used to say to me that I looked like her, it was as though someone stabbed me with a dagger through my heart. You know, I couldn't stand her. And at this stage of the game, when I was doing my fourth step inventory, I realized for the first time that my mother was a woman who was sick just like me. And she had done the very best she could with what she had. And you see, I share that because it was so important for me to come to that realization, because until I did, I was incapable of having a healthy relationship with anyone, any man or any woman, as long as I hated my mother. As long as I kept seeing Rose's face before me in other people, I couldn't have a healthy relationship. And as a result of my fourth and fifth, I was relieved of that hatred. I was willing for the first time to forgive my mother, but more than anything else, I was willing to forgive myself. Because you see, for years I kept blaming her for things. I blamed her for bringing me into a world that was cruel and unfair. I blamed her for making me black. I blamed her for everything. Everything. I blamed her for my drinking and using, for the fact that I slept around, all the things that I had become, I blamed my mother for. And I realized at this stage it wasn't my mother. For the first time in my life, I became willing to take responsibility for my own actions. And that was that other thing that came out of the fourth step for me. The willingness to take responsibility. The recognition that for the first time in my life, I really wasn't a victim. And I had used that to the hilt. I mean, the fact that I'm black, I was a woman, I grew up in poverty, I led a very colorful life. I mean, to me, those were reasons enough to feel victimized. So I believed. And you know, perhaps I might have been justified, I don't know. But the fact is, what you guys taught me was that it didn't matter. It didn't matter. Because if I chose to hold on to those deadly things that were going on in my brain, I was going to drink, and more than that, I'd probably die. And so what came out of that fourth step for me was that I was responsible for my own life. That I may not have had the greatest childhood in the world, but what I chose to do with my life from this point forward was up to me. It had nothing to do with my mother. And that opened up a world for me that was unbelievable. I've received many gifts of self-esteem. The ability to look at myself in the mirror today and like the person that I am and love the person that I'm aspiring to be. It blows me away. It blows me away that today, when I think of myself, I think in terms of clean. I think in terms of respectful. I think in terms that I never thought of before. And you guys gave me that. But one of the most unbelievable gifts has been the ability to show up for myself on a day-to-day basis. To be committed to something and to want to give up, but not give up. When I was 2 years sober, I realized that not only was I uneducated, but I was a horrific liar. And I used to tell people that I had about a year of college, and some people, I'm sure, believed me, but most didn't. And I'm sure that those that didn't kept praying that one day I'd keep coming back and I'd be able to make an amend for the lies that I had made. And I did. I was able to do that in Vegas last Thanksgiving when I spoke at their roundup. But I saw myself as someone who was living a lie, and I didn't want to continue to live that lie. And at the same time, what was going on for me at this second year period was I realized I wanted something in my life more than just not to drink. Now, not drinking and not using drugs was first and foremost, and I don't want to dilute that at all. I don't want to discount the value of that. That was number one. But for this alcoholic, I realized that I needed something more in my life. And I don't know where I came upon this idea, but I decided I wanted to pursue a career that was going to require a serious commitment on my part. Now, I didn't get out of high school. I was 28 years old, and I was 2 years sober, and I was not a high school graduate. So for me to even entertain the thought of doing anything with my life was unheard of. I mean, the only things I knew how to do was to look okay and to be attached to some man. That's what I knew. I knew how to sell myself. You know, I knew how to do those things. I knew how to manipulate. I knew how to get over. But I didn't know how to read. You know, I didn't know how to be my own person. And what was starting to happen was just a yearning inside for some knowledge. I remember they used to give me the traditions to read, and I would storm out of the room because I was too ashamed to tell them I couldn't read. I was too ashamed to ask for help. I could not pronounce the word anonymity, so instead of saying, "Would you help me pronounce this word?" I would storm out of the room, and people would think that I just had a bad attitude, which I did. But more than anything else, what was at work was that I was too afraid and too full of pride that I wouldn't ask for help. And my sponsor said, "Get a dictionary next to you, and whenever you come across a word that you don't understand, look it up." And that, working in concert with just a yearning inside that started to develop, I started to pray for answers. And God put two women in my life. One was a young woman who was 30 years old. She had gone back to school to do hotel administration. And the other was a woman out of West Los Angeles, June G. And June was 21 years old when I met her, and she was 7 years sober, and she was in her second year at UCLA Law School. And both of these women were like unbelievable to me. And I used to go and sit in with Lynn in her classes and just audit them. And I found that I really had a desire to learn. I really had a taste for that. But I still didn't know how I was going to do this thing, you know, this commitment. Most people thought I was crazy in Vegas. They said, "You want to do what with your life? You don't even have a high school diploma. You want to do what?" And I guess all it took were two people, my sponsor and another man, a man in Vegas. They said, "Francine, the sky is the limit. If you become willing to do the footwork, if you don't drink, if you don't use drugs, and you take the action, you can have anything you want." And I said, "But you don't understand. I can't read. You know, I don't have the money. I gave you lots of excuses. I was too old." I came up with one excuse after another why I couldn't do it. And they kept saying, "Just try. Just try. That's what this program has enabled you to do on a day-to-day basis. Just show up." And I started to show up. I went and bought a GED book, and I used to study it. And when company would come, I'd hide it under the bed because, again, I had lied so much. But I studied it nonetheless. And I started school out in Vegas. I went to UNLV for 1 year, and then I moved back to New York in 1982. And for 4 more years, I worked full-time. I went to school full-time, and I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And I stress that because more and more I see new people that start to flex their AA muscles, especially those around 2 and 3 and 4 year sobriety. They go back to school or get into the right relationship or have the right job, and they don't have time for meetings. And maybe they haven't seen enough people go out and die, but I have. And so I continue to go to meetings every day in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I moved back to New York. Well, in 1986, I moved to Washington, D.C. to complete my education. And in 1989, I moved back to New York, having graduated from one of the top law schools in this country. And I'll tell you something, it may not do anything for anybody sitting in this room, but for a kid who used to pay lawyers a fortune to keep her out of jail, the fact that today I can start reaping some of the benefits is unbelievable. The fact that a day at a time, thank you, it's your victory, because you guys got me to this point. The fact that a day at a time I could show up and become an active participant in the creation of my own life is what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me. A lot of the things that happened in the 9.5 years that I put myself through school were really hard, and I wanted to. I didn't want to drink, but I wanted to give up a lot. Sometimes I wanted to cut the lights out because the pain was so great. I didn't want to keep going. And a day at a time, that faith those basics that I learned in my early recovery got me through one day at a time. The last 2 years have been two of the most difficult years for me in my sobriety. I graduated from law school in 1989, and I moved back to New York, and I thought it was going to be smooth sailing. I thought I was going to get this phenomenal job, and everything was going to be great. And I sat for the New York bar on my 10th anniversary, and I thought, because I was sitting for the bar on my 10th anniversary, that that meant I was going to get through it. And I got through it. I showed up for it and I got through it, but I failed the bar the first time. I had to sit for the exam again, and I failed it the second time. And I'll tell you, I don't know how I got the strength to show up for the third test. I do not know how I got the strength. But yet I do know it was that faith and all the work that I had done over the years, continually when I didn't want to do it, that got me to the point that I could sit for that exam for the third time last July. And in November I passed, and I was admitted to the bar this past January, 2 days before my 38th birthday. And and I couldn't stop crying. As I stood being sworn in, I just kept thinking about the 11 and a half years prior to that moment and where I had been 12 years ago on a street corner on 116th Street and 8th Avenue. I kept thinking about the time when I was this hopeless, helpless piece of nothing, and how you guys picked me up and you dusted me off, and you taught me how to become my own best friend. You taught me how to love this person that's standing up here. You taught me that it didn't matter where I came from. It didn't matter what kind of life I led. That it only mattered where I was going. That if I dared to dream, those dreams could come true if I became willing to do the work. And it started by not picking up a drink or a drug, just one day at a time. That's where it started. Today, things still haven't turned out as I'd like them to. I'm in the process of finding work or breaking into an area that's very, very difficult in the law. But a day at a time, I keep showing up. You know, if nothing else, you guys have taught me how to show up very well. A day at a time. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what it has made me. I love what it has allowed me to make of myself. If you are new and you're sitting in here and you're saying none of this stuff makes sense, or it all seems much too hard or much too complicated, it really isn't. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are so simple. We make them complicated. They're very, very simple. They're a design for living. 12 steps of recovery that enable us on a day-to-day basis to become the best people that we could possibly be. I never, in my wildest imaginings, thought I'd be standing before a group of virtual strangers sharing a piece of my life with you. Had someone said that to me 12 years ago, that this is where I'd be and this is what I'd be doing in San Antonio, Texas, I would have said, no way. Or anywhere for that matter. I would have said, no way. But today I am, and I'm so proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm considered in New York an AA cheerleader. And that offends some people. But where I got sober, and with the people that I revere the most, that's a badge to be proud of. I'm a service junkie. I was taught that in order to keep this stuff, it's an imperative that you give it away. You must give it away. That's what they told me. And so I take meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous into rehabs. I go into Covenant House, which is a
a facility for children, a sponsor. I pick up coffee cups at my home group. I pick up chairs. I smile, because I've come to realize that even a smile is a form of service. You know, a hello. If I see a newcomer or someone that I don't recognize in a meeting, I go and say hi to them. And that almost is becoming a lost art in this program. But I was taught that you do it anyway. And maybe that's why I'm still sober a day at a time. In closing, I'd like to read something from AA-approved literature for those of you that are AA purists. This is my most favorite book, as you can probably see. It's like half not even here. It's As Bill Sees It. For those of you that don't know, this is just a wonderful book. And all of our literature is. For those of you that are relatively new and you haven't had an opportunity to explore the literature we have, our books are a treasure trove of information. I mean, you can get lost in it. It is so wonderful. Just pick them up. And this is my favorite. And I like to end with this passage. It's entitled Can We Choose on page 4 of As Bill Sees It. We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And you guys have given me the gift of choice. You've taught me that it really doesn't matter where I've come from, that I can choose to do certain things today. I choose not to drink. I'm one of those people that believes I do have the choice to drink. I choose not to drink. There are loads of bars in New York on every corner. I make a conscious choice. I choose life today, and that's because of you. Thank you for my recovery.